Lecture 8, Sneferu, the Pyramid Builder.
Welcome back. Remember last time how we saw the first pyramid ever built, the Step Pyramid at Saqqara? Well, what I want to do today is I want to take you through to the true pyramid, the great pyramids that we all think about. Now, I'm kind of happy about this lecture more than any other because I get to talk about my favorite pharaoh, somebody you've probably never heard about, Sneferu. But he's the one who taught Egypt how to build the pyramids. Now, one of the things that people don't quite understand is they didn't just build pyramids. They didn't get it right from the beginning. There are disasters. There are pyramids in the deserts that collapsed while they were being built. And Sneferu is the one who sort of endured the disasters and figured out how to get it right. But he did more than that. He also made Egypt an international power. And the third great thing he did was he set artistic standards that were going to last for thousands of years. So to me, Sneferu was the greatest pharaoh that ever lived. But let me start with our Step Pyramid and build up. Remember that the Step Pyramid was just a kind of architectural progression. First, we had burials in the sand pits. Then eventually, that didn't work. So people were buried in rock-cut tombs in the ground so the sand wouldn't wash away, wouldn't be blown away. Then somebody got the idea of, okay, bury them in a rock pit, but put a bench-like structure called a mastaba, a little chapel over it, kind of decorative. People can go, have a meal, pay their respects. And then Imhotep, the architect for the Step Pyramid, got the idea of putting a mastaba on top of a mastaba on top of a mastaba for his pharaoh Zoser. So you get a wedding cake type pyramid, the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, the first building in stone in the history of the world. Now, still, it's that same basic burial. The pharaoh's underground in a rock pit, but now we have a fancy mastaba, the Step Pyramid. But it's not yet a true pyramid. We don't yet have those pyramids that we all think of, the ones with the nice smooth sides. It's Sneferu who's going to show you how to do that one. And let me tell you a little bit about him. First, I mean, he's my favorite pharaoh, but the thing that bothers me about him, there's only one thing that bothers me about him, is we have a few portraits of him. And he looks a little bit like a nerd. He has this receding chin. He doesn't look like this strong, great pharaoh. There's a wonderful monument of him, not a complete monument. It's a stela, and by now you know that a stela is this round-top stone carving. And it's right outside in the garden of the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And most tourists just walk by it. They're eager to get into the museum, see the objects, Tutankhamun's treasures. But it's standing right out there. And if you go, look to the left, and you'll see Sneferu there, carved on a stela with his little receding chin. But you'll see more. Sneferu is also the first pharaoh that we're sure of who carved his name in a cartouche, that oval that represents the king's dominion over the land. In a sense, the cartouche, that oval encircling the pharaoh's name, is a magical circle. Encircling was a notion that the Egyptians used quite a bit in magic. It was protective. So we've got the pharaoh's name in a cartouche. Sneferu is an innovator. He's going to do some new things. But it's a wonderful little stela outside the Egyptian Museum. When you go there, look left, and you'll see it. But he's the pharaoh who attempts the first true pyramid. Now, the first pyramid that he built, and he built several. He's not just a one-pyramid pharaoh. The first pyramid that he built is called the Meidum Pyramid. It's the town where it is. And as soon as you see it, you know that there's something wrong. It doesn't look right. It looks more like a tower, a medieval tower. It's certainly not a pyramid shape. It's got a large pile of sand at the base. By large, I mean it's like 50, 100 feet high almost. It looks like the thing collapsed. It looks like there's just something wrong. Now, Sneferu intended it as a true pyramid. And let me tell you how he started to build it. He built a step pyramid, just like Zoser. But then he decided to fill in the steps with beautiful white limestone, trying to create a true pyramid. But it didn't work. When excavators looked at this pyramid carefully, there was never any indication that it was ever used. It seems to have been abandoned. Why? One theory is that the limestone casing that he used to try to encase the pyramid was slipping. It wasn't stable. It wasn't tied in enough to the body of the pyramid, too smooth, started to slip, and the pyramid had to be abandoned. But the Maidum pyramid is the first attempt at a true pyramid. But it's not just a pyramid. There's more than just that. It's a pyramid complex. He innovates things that were going to be used by the next pharaohs. There's a causeway, a long passageway, that leads down to the valley. And in the valley, Sneferu had a temple built, which we call the Valley Temple. There are many pyramids that have valley temples. We're not 100% sure of the reason for that valley temple. But I think the reason is that's where the pharaoh's body was mummified. So imagine the ceremony that took place. The pharaoh's body is mummified in a temple in the valley. Then by a sacred ceremony, it's brought up the causeway. And the causeway was, it's a narrow passageway. You know, maybe 7-8 feet wide, that's all. Maybe a little bit more. And it's roofed over, about 7 feet high, with a roof over it. So priests are carrying the body of the pharaoh to the pyramid for burial. Now, this mortuary temple, as we call it, there's a mortuary temple that's right next to the pyramid. And it's an interesting monument, a mortuary temple. The mortuary temple was used by the pharaoh so that priests could come and make offerings to his soul forever. It was a place where you could leave food, offerings. So he's got a valley temple where his body's mummified, a causeway. Right next to the pyramid is a mortuary temple. Quite a bit of a complex. It's not just a simple pyramid. Now, the pyramid itself has innovations that were way ahead of its time. First, this is the first above-ground burial in a pyramid. Now, remember, Zoser, the builder of the step pyramid, is still buried underground. He's just got the step pyramid wedding cake above him. Sneferu decides to have his body buried above the ground. So for the pyramid, you go into the pyramid, and you go down more than 100 feet, into the bedrock, and then you climb up a little stairway, and there's a burial chamber. Sneferu intended to be buried in that burial chamber above ground. Now, it creates an architectural problem that had to be solved. Think about this. The pharaoh's body is inside the pyramid now, but towards the bottom of the pyramid. You've got millions of pounds of stone on the ceiling of the burial chamber. How do you roof over a large area? How do you roof over something, say, the size of a living room with 1 million pounds of stone above it? You can't put a slab of granite across the ceiling and have that as your ceiling because that will crack. What do you do? Well, he solved it by what we call a corbelled ceiling. What he did in the burial chamber is he took stones and he built up the walls of stones, and each layer of stone moves inward a little bit. It moves inward and inward and inward, creating what we call a corbelled ceiling. Till you get at the top, it looks a little bit like an arch made out of steps, stepping in, till the top, you only have an inch or two is the last block at the very top. So all the weight of the pyramid doesn't come down on one big slab, it's distributed through the pyramid. So a corbelled ceiling is a clever way of doing this. Sneferu solved that problem. First above-ground burial ever for a pharaoh. But as I say, the pyramid wasn't used. He had two stelae erected, these large stone round-top things that were supposed to be inscribed. And they're still there. They are still right there by the mortuary temple, but they're uninscribed. They were never used. That's one way we're pretty sure that this pyramid was never used, because he would have had inscriptions with his name all over the place. The casing stones probably started slipping. They realized the pyramid was unstable, and it was abandoned. Let me tell you a curious thing about this pyramid and other pyramids. It's a tremendous effort to build a pyramid. Manpower, social organization, and we'll talk about that later. But how come they're never inscribed? If you go inside the Pyramid of Maidum, there are no inscriptions. There is no way in the world that you could tell that this was Sneferu's pyramid. He didn't put his name on it, didn't claim it. Maybe the stela would have done that, but there are no inscriptions. The only reason we know this is Sneferu's pyramid, the only reason, is that there's graffiti on the wall of the mortuary temple. Old graffiti. 18th dynasty graffiti. Roughly the time of King Tutankhamun, 1,000 years later. A priest came to the temple, and he said, "I came to the temple of Sneferu in it, and it was beautiful. Only because of this inscription are we pretty sure that this was Sneferu's pyramid. Now, what did Sneferu do? Right, he's built a pyramid, and it's unusable. He starts another pyramid. The next pyramid he builds is at a place called Dashur. Now, Dashur has the second pyramid that Sneferu built. It's called the Bent Pyramid. It's called the Bent Pyramid because it starts out, nice angle, and when it gets to the top, it bends. It looks like, up, they change the plan all of a sudden, and it bends at the top. Now, why does it bend at the top? Well, I'll give you an answer. They had problems with this pyramid too. Major problems. A pyramid is not built on sand. That's your first rule of pyramid building. Sand shifts. It's unstable. You built it on bedrock. The corners of the bent pyramid were built on unstable ground. And what happened was, they started shifting. And the pyramid started moving inward. Now, let me tell you about what's inside this pyramid, this bent pyramid. I've been in it. It is very dangerous. It is the most dangerous thing I've ever done, is going to the burial chamber of Sneferu. You go down this long descending passageway, more than 100 feet down. And then to get up to the burial chamber, you climb a ladder that is 55 feet high. Right? The burial chamber, there are actually two burial chambers in this pyramid. The burial chamber was probably the greatest room ever built on the planet by the time it was built. It is 55 feet high, with a corbelled ceiling going all the way up for 55 feet. It's a huge room, the largest enclosed room probably ever built up until that time. But, as I said, the corners were unstable. When you look inside that burial chamber, you get a shock. It's filled with cedar beams. There are huge beams going from wall to wall, holding the walls apart. The walls have huge cracks in them. What happened? Because the corners were shifting, the weight of the pyramid started coming inward, imploding on the wall, cracking the wall. The wall started to move inward, and to keep it from totally collapsing inward, they brought in cedars of Lebanon to hold the walls apart. Then, what I figure they did was, this pyramid isn't going to work either, his second disaster. It's got to be abandoned. It's not stable. They decided to finish it anyway, but to finish it quickly, they put a bend at the top because it requires less stone, do it faster, and they simply abandoned it. Sneferu's second pyramid was abandoned. Now, this is a large pyramid. It's nearly as large as the Great Pyramid at Giza. This is not a small affair. You know, it's a couple hundred feet high. But Sneferu was not going to give up. Now, this pyramid at Dashur, the bent pyramid, it also has a valley temple, it has a causeway, it had everything, but it couldn't be used. What did Sneferu do? Goes a mile away, still at Dashur, and builds a third pyramid, the Red Pyramid. Now, the Red Pyramid is called the Red Pyramid because when it shines in the sun, you know, when the sun is on it, shining, it looks a little bit red, right? So Sneferu starts a third pyramid, and he completes it. And that's where Sneferu was buried. And this is the first large, true pyramid in the history of the world. It's really Sneferu who showed the world how to build pyramids. That's where Egypt really, by trial and error, though, there were disasters, there were problems. Sneferu just didn't give up. Incredible pharaoh. Now, pyramid building was only one of his things, right? Only one of the things he did. He made Egypt an international power. And let me tell you about that. First, remember when he had to bring in cedars of Lebanon to keep the walls apart inside that collapsing pyramid? Had to go to Lebanon to get it. Now, remember, Egypt is not a tree-rich country. There are no forests in Egypt. But they needed wood, always, for Nile boats. They needed the wood for boats. So you had to get wood somewhere. And Lebanon was the place to get the cedar. Sneferu organized expeditions, trading expeditions. They didn't pillage and plunder, but trading expeditions to Lebanon to get cedar for these boats. Now, it wasn't just for boats, though. You needed great cedars of Lebanon for doors to temples. You needed cedars of Lebanon for the flagpoles that were in front of temples. There was plenty of need for cedar, and Sneferu did it. International expedition. The first one we're really sure that goes into international soil. That was Sneferu. And let me say a little bit about boats in ancient Egypt. If you wanted to travel any long distance in Egypt, and you had a little bit of wealth, you went by boat. It's the only way to do it. We see lots of representations of boats on the walls of Egyptian tombs and temples. But let me say this right out in front, statement of fact, the Egyptians were terrible sailors. They weren't really skilled at sailing because they were spoiled by the Nile. It was a very easy navigation to do. You see, the current always flows from south to north. Now, the reason a river flows in one direction rather than the other is simply plate tectonics. The plate simply slipped under when the earth was being formed. The plate is under, and water just flows downhill. So the Nile flows always south to north. The prevailing wind is always north to south. So if you're going one way, say you're going up the river, you put up your sails, you got the wind at your back, you're sailing along. If you're coming home, you can put down your sails, put in your oars for steering, and you're going home. It's easy. As a matter of fact, if you look at tomb paintings, you can tell if a boat is going north or south by whether its sails are up. It's kind of a neat thing. But this spoiled the Egyptians. They really weren't good sailors. They never liked to go out on the Mediterranean, for example. They never. I mean, they called the Mediterranean the Wajwur, the Greek green. Right? It was like this, woo. And when they did trading expeditions, that was really a bold thing. So for Sneferu to go to Lebanon to get cedars was a big deal, a really big deal. But he had this kind of international idea. He was not afraid of going beyond the borders of Egypt. And let me tell you about some other things he did. He sent mining expeditions to the Sinai. Now, the Sinai was foreign land. And why go to the Sinai? They had turquoise. Turquoise was not found in Egypt. You know, it's in the Sinai. And it was a beautiful blue stone that they liked for jewelry. So it's Sneferu who sends an expedition to the Sinai. Now, this was a major thing to do. First of all, this was barbarian territory. This was foreign territory. You had to have an army. And Sneferu had an army. And all along the Sinai, he carved inscriptions of himself. And you know what it says? It shows Sneferu in that smiting pose, the same as the Narmer palette. Right hand up with the mace on his, you know, the mace, the rock on a stick in his hand, ready to smite an enemy. It shows him, ready to smite an enemy. And it says, Sneferu, smiter of barbarians. Right? So he went with an army. Now, when you went to the Sinai, though, this was a tough, tough expedition. You had to have boats to go across, right? You needed boats. You needed organization. And sometimes, he said there were expeditions that went in the summer. Right, which is incredibly hot. There are inscriptions in the Sinai about from Sneferu's men. It says, you know, the mountain branded our skin. It was so hot working in the turquoise mines. Now, working turquoise is very difficult. You follow a vein through a little tunnel. I mean, you're often on your belly just carving away at little bits of turquoise. I'll never forget going into the Sinai about, must be 20 years ago, I wanted to see Sneferu's turquoise mines. I just wanted to see them. And I went to the Sinai, and I talked to the locals. I asked some Bedouins, where are the turquoise mines? They said, oh, come on, we'll go show you. Guy hops in a jeep, goes with me. And there's this little tunnel going into the mountain. I mean, I had crawling on my belly. And he says to me, the Bedouin says to me, he said, the miner's in there now. His name is Salem. I'll never forget. The little man. So we go inside, and I yell, Salem! And he comes out, right? Little old man, climbing, I mean, tiny man. And we were talking in Arabic, you know, and I said to him, do you have any turquoise? I was with quite a few of my students. We were going on this kind of little expedition. And I said, do you have any turquoise? And he said, yes. And I said, gee, could we buy some? He said, sure. So he takes out of his pocket maybe six or seven little chunks of turquoise, little bits. And I asked him, how much are they? The whole thing probably can't be the equivalent of a dollar. Right? And he gives me the. And I said to him, how do you make a living? He says, well, I go in the turquoise mine, and I take out the turquoise, and I put it in a box, and once a month, a friend of mine takes a bus, he goes to Cairo, and he sells it in the bazaar in Cairo. And how much could the man make? I have no idea. Next to nothing. And I said to him, I was curious, I said, Solomon, why do you do this? You know, you really don't make a lot of money. And his answer just blew me away. He said, I mean, it's translating from the Arabic, but basically he said to me, who wants a 9-to-5 job? What he meant was, and I asked it, he said, you know, the people with the goats, they have to get up every morning and bring them to the pasture land. They have them to take care of them. He said, I'm free. If I one day don't want to get out of bed, I don't have to get out of bed. And that's a turquoise miner, probably the last turquoise miner in the Sinai. But the inscriptions are really quite something. And the turquoise mines go up and down a mountain. And sometimes you have to go way up a mountain and then tunnel in. A very, very dangerous expedition. And many, many people died. And you know what Sneferu did? It was really kind of neat. On top of the mountain, there's a temple for the miners to worship at. And it's dedicated to Hathor, the goddess Hathor, who is sometimes shown as a cow-headed goddess. And her name was Our Lady of Turquoise there. She was the patron saint of the turquoise miners. So Sneferu really was not afraid of really sending things out into the foreign lands. This site, this temple on top of a mountain, has a name. I don't know what it means. It's Arabic. Serbit al-Khadim. That's what the Arabs call it. The locals call it that. It was excavated by Flinders Petrie, that our man Petrie. And you know, Petrie found, when he was excavating, a sphinx. A small sphinx, maybe 5 feet long, perhaps the most. But he couldn't get it down from the mountain. And he didn't want to leave it there because he was afraid it would be broken. So he buried it up on top of the mountain. But he never put the X on the map that marks where the sphinx is. So someday some excavator is going to find a sphinx from the top of Serapeh Dachadim in the Sinai. But Sneferu did great things, really wonderful things. Let me tell you about some other things. He also set the standards for art. During Sneferu's reign, he created jewelry that nobody else had ever seen. His wife had beautiful turquoise jewelry. Right? Inlays, like in the shape of butterflies from the turquoise mines. This was the most fashionable thing you could see. But he also had statues of his children made, life-size statues out of stone that are spectacular. They are the masterpieces of Egyptian art, and they come at the beginning of the history of art. And these were things that artists would shoot for the next centuries after. There's a wonderful one in the Egyptian Museum of Rahotep, who was a priest of Memphis, his son, and his wife Nefret. Now, what's really wonderful, they're realistic, they're life-size, they're full-size, beautifully painted, and they have rock crystal eyes. So the eyes actually look real. And the details are just perfect. If you look at the hair of Nofret, you will see that she's wearing a wig. Egyptian women, usually wealthy Egyptian women, often wore wigs. Made of human hair, fairly large, like big hair, and they would put it over their natural hair. And if you look at Nefert, you can see she's wearing a wig, and what they've shown is on her forehead is her natural hair peeking out. I mean, lovely little details. And some of his sons were represented in these full life-size statues. And what's neat about the sons is they're shown as fat. For example, Hemienu, who was an architect and a vizier. See, Sneferu knew what to do. He was putting all the power, keeping it in his family. His viziers, the prime ministers of Egypt, and the architects who built the other pyramids, they were all his sons. And if you look at Hemienu, he's got rolls of fat. Now, that wasn't a bad thing. That was a sign of prosperity. That showed you could afford to eat well. And another sign, Ankhaf, is also shown. He's bald and fat, really paunchy. This is success. But these are beautiful, realistic statues. And Sneferu is the one who showed Egypt how to do the statues, too. How to set standards for sculpture that would last for thousands of years. But that's not all. Sneferu is the pharaoh about whom we have the first personal anecdote. We know a little bit about his personality even. I mean, he comes alive for me. I really feel I know who the guy was. There's a papyrus in Berlin called Papyrus Westcar. It's just a story, but I think it tells something about Snefer. It's a magical papyrus. It has magical stories. And it tells the story of Snefer being bored one day. And his prime minister says to him, you know, why don't you go rowing? Have the ladies of the court take you rowing. And to cheer you up, let's just give them fishnet dresses. Right? This is the first use of exotic fishnet dresses. Right? So he was going to have these handmaidens rowing him on the Nile in his boat to kind of cheer him up. He was bored. And they did it. The young ladies are in their fishnet dresses. They're rowing Sneferu. And one of the young women is wearing a pendant around her neck. And it's a turquoise fish amulet. Turquoise, right? She's a la mode. It's the newest thing, a real treasure, right from the mines. And she leans over the ship just to kind of look down, and it falls off her neck. She starts crying. She's lost her amulet. And Sneferu, he's the king of Egypt, a god on earth, right? God on earth. He stops. He says, what's the matter? And she explains, I've lost my amulet, my turquoise amulet. And Sneferu says, don't worry, I'll get you another amulet. She says, no. She says, I want my turquoise amulet. Now, think of that. This young woman is saying to the pharaoh, no, I want my turquoise amulet. There's a sense that this pharaoh was approachable. He was a good guy. He wasn't sort of this, you know, domineering pharaoh. So what does Sneferu do? He calls a magician who comes and parts the waters. Now, this is like Exodus, but a thousand years before Exodus. But we have a story of the waters being parted. There on a rock is the turquoise fish amulet. Magician fetches it, gives it back to the girl. She stops crying, continues rowing, and life goes on. It's a fiction, of course. It didn't really happen. But I think from this you get a little bit of a sense that Sneferu was an approachable pharaoh. He was somebody that you could talk to. I mean, I just like the guy. I also, when I think about his personality, I think about the idea that he just didn't quit. You know? Think about that. He builds one pyramid, my doom. It's abandoned. The casing stones perhaps aren't tied in well enough. Then he goes on to build the largest building in the history of the world at that time, the Bent Pyramid. And it starts imploding. It won't work. Now, at this point, he's running out of time. He's probably fairly elderly, and he knows that he's got to get it right or he's not going to have a burial place. He doesn't give up. He doesn't go for some small tomb. He builds a third pyramid. Right? This is a sense of a man that fearless. That's why he's my favorite pharaoh. Now, think about what Sneferu has done. He has shown Egypt how to build the pyramids. First one to get it right for a true pyramid. The first true pyramid. He's built actually three pyramids. Three. Twice the volume of the Great Pyramid. He's then taken Egypt and made it an international power. He has gone to Lebanon for cedar, goes into the Sinai for turquoise mines. Right? Then he establishes artistic conventions, standards that are going to be... I mean, many people feel they were never met again. Many people feel that the art of Sneferu's era is the best art that Egypt ever produced. It's an incredible legacy for one man. But he's got still one more legacy. What may be Sneferu's greatest legacy is his son, Khufu, who built the Great Pyramid of Giza. And that's what we'll talk about next time.